The 20th year in the life of the United Nations is being observed throughout the world as International Cooperation Year, in the belief that greater awareness of the achievements of cooperation, rather than a preoccupation with conflict, will advance the cause of peace and human welfare. On this theme, United Nations Radio is presenting a series of special programs on the extent and nature of cooperation through international organizations. In this program, called Wires and Waves, the speaker is Alexander Scorby.
In the procedures of the UN General Assembly, a roll call vote by more than 100 nations can consume a surprising amount of time. But no matter, when the issue is important enough and everyone wants to know where everyone stands, a roll call is likely to be requested. All right. I'm going to call a roll right now. Baden.
Ja.
Bavaria.
Ja.
Hamburg.
Ja.
Hanover.
Ja.
Prussia.
Ja.
Saxony.
Ja.
Württemberg.
Ja.
You think I'm crazy? You never heard of such places, even on the lengthy list of new nations? Well, leaving the question of my personal sanity aside, let me explain. They're not new nations, if nations is the right term, but old ones. The German principalities of the 19th century. And their unanimous ja's were voiced in 1865, not today. In that year, along with some still familiar neighbors like Belgium and Denmark, they were invited to Paris by Emperor Napoleon III to negotiate an agreement. The product of their discussions and votes was the first international intergovernmental organization, the International Telegraph Union, now 100 years later called the International Telecommunication Union. ITU, our congratulations on a long cooperative life and many happy returns. Now, the stimulus which created the ITU was the very uncooperative confusion which developed with the spread of the telegraph as a means of international communication during the 1840s and 50s. As the wires began to span frontiers, nations became more zealous than usual in exercising their sovereign rights. They would impose discriminatory taxes on foreign messages handled by their domestic services. They would insist on breaks in the lines at borders. They would transmit their own messages first, while others gathered dust in the outbasket, sometimes for several days. By 1865, everyone had become sufficiently irritated by this state of affairs to ensure the success of the Paris meeting, and the new union got to work on internationally acceptable telegraph regulations. Since then, of course, the ITU has acquired many more responsibilities. At the turn of the century, for example, wireless telegraphy was already being widely used by ships at sea. But even this new technical marvel was handicapped for a while by non-technical problems. Let me illustrate with a true story. In 1902, Prince Henry of Prussia visited President Theodore Roosevelt in Washington. On the ship on his way home, he decided to thank the president for his hospitality by sending him a wireless message. But he failed. The ship's operator had to explain that he was out of range of shore stations in the United States and that he couldn't send the message to a station in England and ask them to relay it. Why? Because the equipment on the ship had been made and installed by a different company from the one which equipped English stations. This splendid case of myopic commercial rivalry was not an isolated one. In those days, wireless telegraphy stations would only communicate with each other if their equipment came from the same manufacturer. Well, the prince took a poor view of the situation, and so did the emperor when he heard about it. As a result, two more conferences were held in Berlin in 1903 and 1906. At them, 29 states agreed on the first set of international radio regulations, among them being, by the way, the one making the signal SOS, the universally accepted distress call. By 1927, the ITU was facing another problem. The airwaves had become filled not only with dots and dashes, but with words and music. Radio was now the new entertainment medium. Small boys with earphones, cat's whisker, and crystal, and adults with tubes and loudspeakers were listening to an ever-increasing number of broadcasting stations. In fact, In some areas, an electromagnetic traffic jam was building up. With bedlam a distinct possibility, 80 nations got together in Washington, set up an international radio consultative committee, and made the first allocation of frequencies to the various radio services. These days, the ITU's Frequency Registration Board, made up of 11 experts who work as the impartial custodians of an international public trust, maintains a master frequency register and decides whether the frequencies which countries assign to their radio stations conform to the international radio regulations and do not interfere with other stations. How well countries cooperate in this can be judged by the fact that every week the board deals with nearly 2,000 frequency assignments and changes in assignment from all over the world. Now, this is a very incomplete history of the ITU, and it only brings us up to the early post-war years. It's a history that may well suggest that the nations in the Union have only given a cooperative response to a problem long after a rapidly developing technology has created one, rather than getting together before it arises. And let's admit it, that's largely true. However, with the dawn of the present decade, something significant happened. With satellites of various shapes, sizes, and functions already orbiting the Earth, a new dimension had been added to our techniques of communication. And in 1961, the UN General Assembly formally noted that the ITU had wide responsibilities in regulating the sounds and signals from outer space, just as it has in earthbound radio, telegraphs, and telephones. Thus it was that on October 7th, 1963, a space communications conference opened in Geneva, and UN Radio in New York was able to record this instantaneous exchange of greetings between Secretary General Thant and Gerald Gross, the Secretary General of the ITU. Mr. Thant sat in his office at UN headquarters, and Mr. Gross was in the Assembly Hall at the Palace of Nations in Geneva. Not only did they speak to each other, but they could see each other. Hundreds of miles above the TV cameras focused on the two men was the means, the communication satellite Telstar. Let me play a little of that historic recording. Mr. Thant speaks first.
I'm very happy indeed to be participating from across the Atlantic in the first conference on space communications called by the International Telecommunications Union. I believe that the principles and regulations that you agree upon at the present time should be flexible enough to provide maximum scope for advanced scientific research and free cultural exchange. This is clearly a field in which the interests of all nations can be served most efficiently and economically by international cooperative action. I hope that your conference will provide the medium by which such cooperative action could be agreed upon.
For a moment or two, a slight hissing sound. Then, from Geneva, the voice of Mr. Gross via outer space.
Mr. Secretary General, in the name of the ITU, may I thank you most warmly. The world is on the threshold of a new age which all countries and the governments and peoples which compose them are determined to make as spiritually and materially enriching as they can for humanity. In order that space operations, whether they be for exploration and research, telecommunications, meteorology, radio navigation, or radio astronomy, may develop harmoniously and to the full, there must be international agreement on the assignment of frequencies for radio communication.
At that 1963 conference, more than 400 delegates from 70 of ITU's member states did reach agreement on the allocation of frequencies for the various space activities just mentioned by Gerald Gross. They also anticipated some things to come, such as direct reception by the general public of all countries of sound and television programs from satellites. At the moment, of course, the few space spectaculars that some can see and hear have to pass through a central receiving station before being fed to a national broadcasting network. The conference recommended that studies on the technical problems of broadcasting from satellites be speeded up and that the use and sharing of frequency bands be in the mutual interest of all nations. In other words, if there's been rather a lot of hindsight in the past, there is some healthy foresight now. But space communication, though an almost miraculous reality already, remains for the moment a largely potential rather than an actual servant of mankind. And it is perhaps in the ordinary, routine, day-to-day operation of international telephone and telegraph services that one can appreciate the extraordinary degree of cooperation that exists. Personally, I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm still unsophisticated enough to get a big thrill out of being able to pick up a phone in my own home and, providing I pay the bill, call someone in another land, in another hemisphere. My instinct keeps telling me that the whole business is impossible, like the sight of a helicopter hovering in midair. And yet it works, and works better with each new technical refinement. It works because different people work together to make it work. Let's slip in an illustration. Last February, the UN Economic Commission for Africa began its 1965 session in Nairobi, Kenya's capital. From New York, on the opening day, United Nations Radio got through to a correspondent on the spot for a report on the proceedings. Here's a recording of how the call went through, with the UN contacting the New York operator, New York contacting Nairobi, and Nairobi responding with a dispatch.
Hello, UN. Okay, want to try it through to Nairobi?
Right, thank you. Hello, Nairobi. This is United Nations in New York calling Nairobi. United Nations in New York calling Nairobi. Please come in, Nairobi.
Yes, this is Nairobi Terminal. We are putting it through to VOK now.
Thank you, Nairobi Terminal. Can you put us through to the studio, please?
Have we got New York on the line?
This is New York United Nations studio on the line.
Okay, now when do we start?
Right now.
We're rolling.
Okay, well, we start with Oliver Jackman. Ready?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Swift and smooth. And it'll be swifter and smoother in the future. The day is coming when, no matter where you are, it will be possible to dial automatically any place in the world. An ITU committee has completed a global interconnections plan for telecommunications, together with routing and numbering plans. So, what does it all add up to? There's something more to the story of modern communications than just technical ingenuity. I've heard it called a new phenomenon in history, an extension of the brain of an individual man. But an extension towards what? A former premier of France, Edgar Faure, supplied an answer in a lecture on international cooperation which he gave recently in the UN General Assembly Hall.
Pour la première fois, nous voyons s'esquisser une civilisation sans frontières.
Now, for the first time, we see the makings of a civilization without frontiers or watertight compartments, universal in both the extent of its geographical dimensions and the depths of its social dimensions. Cooperation means nothing else but that.
Obviously, of course, communication techniques by themselves will not give us this new civilization. Everything depends on how they're used, on what is communicated. At the same time, without them, and without the cooperation they involve, we would never have reached even the present interdependent state of the world. And that is saying a very great deal.
You have just heard Alexander Scorby in one of a series of special programs produced by United Nations Radio in observance of 1965, International Cooperation Year.